Hello, investors. I'm speaking with Eric Rosen. Eric's a former head of credit trading at JP Morgan. In that role, he had a front row seat during the great financial crisis. He also ran fixed income at UBS and founded a hedge fund called Reef Road Capital. He's now retired. He's advising companies sitting on boards, and he also writes the Rosen Report, and that's followed by many influential people in the finance community. Now, before we get started, a quick reminder that all views Eric expresses are his own. They're not investment recommendations or advice. What's your view on the path from here? And, you know, let's start with the financial sector, given rates and headwinds of a slowing economy. You mentioned more implications for regional banks. Let's touch on that for a minute. And how might tighter credit really work through the economy and, you know, earnings that we all see on Wall Street?
Well, listen, I think there's institutions that are too big to fail. And when I look at JP Morgan, Bank of America, Citibank, Wells, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, I'm comfortable there. And, you know, I, as I said, I think the pullback in lending will help to reduce inflation and slow growth. You know, one perfect example of how it's going to work through the economy is we saw loan rejection rates at 9.1% in February from 5.5% a few months prior. The March data, I believe, comes out tomorrow, and I'm anxious to see where that goes, but I can't imagine it's gone down. I would think that the rejection rates are going to continue to climb. You know, I spoke about consumer debt levels raising, savings crashing, and now their access to credit will be hampered. I'm not forecasting Armageddon, but I am concerned about earnings, the consumer and regional banks. In 2007-08, I was very, very, very short the market through stocks, through bonds, through credit derivatives. Today, I'm long cash instruments like short-dated treasuries and money markets as I wait for opportunities to present themselves. So I don't have, I was screaming at the top of my roof, at the rooftops in 2007 and 8 that the world was going to end. And I didn't want to go out in 2007 and 8. I didn't want to go out to dinner with people on Saturday night because I was such a Debbie Downer, because I saw the end of the world coming and people were like, damn, Eric, you're so depressing. And I didn't want to, I was like, became a recluse because I didn't want to be with anybody. I'm not there. I'm not anywhere there. So I have large cash positions today as opposed to being outright short. You know, I think for the first time in a long time, we're actually getting paid to take risk in fixed income securities, whether it's government bonds or whether it's munis, high grade, high yield. You know, we're finally starting to see it. Remember, Fed funds was effectively zero for a number of years. But over the last 50 years, Fed funds rate has averaged 5.42%. So you can get paid 4 to 5% between 2 month and 3 year treasuries today. And so for me, waiting out the period of being a little uncomfortable and getting paid 5% to do it, or if I wanted to play in high grade bonds a little bit more and high yield bonds, even a little bit more than that, you know, to me makes sense.
Yeah, me too. And just FYI, you can come out for dinner with me anytime, Eric.
Yeah. Thanks. If you're paying, I'm ordering lobster.
Absolutely. So how will we know if it's getting to a more concerning point here? What are some things investors can do to protect your wealth? You mentioned a couple, but how do we look at things here?
Okay. I think you need to be smart. You know, I don't think the banking crisis is over, and I don't think the U.S. is going to probably back every deposit. You know, systemically important institutions is where you keep cash. If you have to, I'd be mindful of the $250,000 limits at places. I talked about JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells, Goldman, Morgan Stanley. And I mean, there's others, but those are the big ones. You know, I'm keeping less cash in banks. I think you're getting paid to take money, get paid in short dated treasuries and munis, as I said. So I'm using that. And, you know, quite frankly, your listeners and 99.999% of the world really lack the required skill to analyze a bank's balance sheet. And quite frankly, the Fed missed it. Rating agencies missed it. So I don't expect the average American to look at the balance sheet of a bank and go, oh, wow, they have an asset liability mismatch. I better take my money out of bank A and put it in bank B. I just think it's being smart, you know, buying securities as opposed to keeping cash in the bank, and being mindful of the $250,000 FDIC limits in case those are viewed. Now, think about it. Like, I like First Republic Bank. I think it's a great bank. The stock was, last I checked yesterday, down 89% over the last roughly year. So even though it's a well-run bank, and remember, that bank got $30 billion of deposits, led by all the big banks, deposited $30 billion to try to stabilize that bank, yet the stock is still down 89%.
Yeah.
So that's telling me all I need to know. I actually have a small account of probably $6,000 there because I have a I have an insurance trust that's paid out of First Republic Bank. So I wouldn't be keeping massive money at First Republic Bank. I do think that bank will get sold or broken up in parts, because a stock down 89% tells me all I need to know, even with all the support from the other banks. PacWest Bank is down 56, Western Alliance down 46, Zions Bank's down was down 40. However, we talk about this is nowhere like 2007 and 8 and 9. JP Morgan is up 3 or 4%, Wells is up 5%, Bank of America's down maybe 10, Goldman Sachs is, you know, either side of break even. You know, so we're not seeing the pain across all banks. Not all banks are created equal today. Whereas in 2008 and 9, every bank, every financial institution and virtually every company was really destroyed. You know, I don't want to give specific advice about, oh, buy this stock or don't buy that stock. But what I'd say is, you know, you have to be mindful about what's going on and be sure to have savings. Think about how you spend money today. You know, paying down those high-priced credit cards. I told you Forbes has an article, the APR on credit cards is 24%. Put off non-discretionary spending. The instant gratification society we live in is dangerous. All those influencers make us feel awful about ourselves. You know, I have a 15-year-old daughter, and all day she's on social media and sees the perfect lives and all these people with fancy cars and big homes and private planes and fancy dinners and new clothes and beautiful vacations. And it pushes us to do things we shouldn't be doing. There was a saying when I was a kid, keeping up with the Joneses, and that meant you were trying to keep up with your next door neighbor. If they got a new car, you wanted one. Now we're keeping up with people we don't know and never are going to meet and are not even real. A lot of the stuff you see on social media is smoke and mirrors. And I write a lot about that. And I've written a lot about the impact of social media on children. And these people don't have private planes and Rolls Royces, and they're rented or borrowed, and they make you feel awful about yourself. So it makes you go out and spend money. Right. And I think that's unhealthy. And, you know, I would like, you know, to think that the damage to kids is pretty, unfortunately, pretty bad, you know, from that. And there are countless stories of Photoshop, you know, that are really impacting people. Today, 36% of Americans do not have more debt than emergency savings. And it was 22% in 2021. Yeah. So today, we have more severely delinquent auto loans than any time since 2006. 17% of Americans, as I said, are paying over $1,000 a month relative to five. And, you know, we're starting to see that. On the real estate front, there are pockets that are far worse than others. Downtown office, especially blue states, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, LA, for example. Urban retail and business hotels are struggling. You know, onerous mandates and lockdowns and work from home rules in the blue states really destroyed many businesses, you know, especially office and retail. One friend called these cities that I mentioned COVID Chernobyl, which I thought was a good name. You know, I expect a fair amount of defaults in the office space, and we're seeing more in office and retail just in the last month. Some pretty notable office, some equity owners turn the keys back to the lenders in the last month or two, and we're going to see more of that. However, apartments, high-end resorts, and generally things in the Sun Belt have held up quite well. I can tell you, I published a piece last night. Palm Beach new office space, One Flagler, is going for over $150 a foot for office space in Palm Beach. Miami, there's a new building that's trying to get $180 a foot. When I ran my hedge fund in New York City, I was two blocks from Grand Central Station at 47th and 3rd. I thought it was a B building, but it was an A location. It was only two blocks from Grand Central. I was paying $65 a foot. I could rent that same building because of concessions and the fact that they're going to give you free rent and do build out for effectively $48 a foot today. So as the rents in South Florida have quadrupled or doubled or tripled, depending on what you're talking about, the rents in places like New York, San Francisco, LA, Chicago, DC are really going the other way. And so there are pockets where it's holding up. Well, apartments are holding up pretty well. You still have pretty high, you know, you have very low vacancy rates. You know, occupancy rates are very high. And although rents are coming down a little, they're much, much higher than they were pre-COVID. So there are pockets that are holding up well, but really downtown office and retail and business hotels are the ones that are struggling.
Yeah. And you make great points, Eric. Banks aren't monolithic anymore. Real estate, not monolithic, but credit as you pointed out, tightening in a lot of different places. You mentioned car loans, real estate, et cetera, higher costs of credit. What concerns you the most going forward? Where do we look for the cracks that could have ripple effects, you know, beyond the regional banks? And how much could that impact corporate earnings and I guess by implication, the overall stock market?
Yeah, you know, I talked about small and medium banks driving lending in the United States, and the access to credit is an issue for me. You know, I touched on it for a second, but I'll go into a little bit more detail about the owner of this company in the construction business. They are desperate in need of working capital facility because they're growing so fast. They have negative working capital and they need to borrow money to get their inventory and pay their people the way that they pay their salespeople at the time of sale. And they cannot get a loan. No bank will lend them money. And so I recommended them. I said, you cannot grow. Growth will put you out of business because you lack the capital to pay your bills. And so, you know, that's a perfect example of things slowing down. I'm concerned about the venture space, you know, given SVB and the outsized role they played there. You know, I hope your venture startup is funded for 2 or 3 years. You don't want to have to try and raise capital right now because it'll be very hard. And I think earnings are forecast to decline. Well, higher rates and tighter lending standards make companies scramble to find capital. I think those with floating rate debt and near-term maturities are one to watch, especially in the real estate space. I would not want to have a near-term maturity in a commercial real estate property coming in the next year if I could help it. Having said that, I've been shocked by the resiliency of the stock market. You know, if I gave you all the headlines that we just talked about, you sure wouldn't think the stock market is where it is. So I think it's been a bit more resilient than I thought it would be. But I do worry about the consumer, and every day I'm seeing more concerns about them starting to roll over and pull back in what they're buying, across the board.
Well, you know, it is one of the most confusing times in the markets that I've seen, and I've been involved for 25, 30 years as well. Let's go back to Druckenmiller. We're both fans. He takes a lot of information from what the market is telling him, and the market's been telling a lot of people that there's a cyclical bent, i.e., you know, a recovery taking hold. Now, that may or may not be true. We'll have to wait and see, but it's been very interesting, and I think, you know, problematic for people who came into the year really bearish. So let's look at the reverse scenario for a minute. A soft landing or a case where a recession could be short-lived. I mean, what's the probability of that in your view? And also, what signs do we watch for that would indicate Powell and his team can engineer a more favorable outcome for the economy than, you know, dire recession right in front of us?
I like the question, and I'm going to be critical of some of the actors here. I'm going to start on a positive note. The banking challenges are going to temper inflation at a faster rate than they otherwise would. The lack of lending will help inflation come down faster than if there was no pullback in lending. I personally feel the Fed is too stuck on a 2% number for inflation and should use a little bit more judgment. Months ago, I called for lower rates in 2023. And middle of 2022, end of 2022, I was saying, I think there are going to be cuts in 2023. People said I was crazy. That'll never happen. And now it's actually priced into the market. As of last night, I didn't check this morning, there was an 80% probability of a 25 basis point hike in the next meeting, but now they're pricing in about 30, 35 basis points of cuts, you know, in the remainder of the year. So that tells you the economy is slowing. My base case is for a recession in the next year. It's not going to be a global financial crisis recession, but I think we're going to be in a recession is my base case. And on the Fed, this is where I'm going to be critical. I have no faith in the Fed to engineer anything. To me, it appears the more PhDs you have from fancy schools, and then when they get in a room together, the worse the final answer. Ben Bernanke said, subprime is contained in March of 2007, and there would be no recession. Oops, global financial crisis. Then the Fed left rates too low for too long, and were way too dovish post-global financial crisis, and again in 2021. Powell and Yellen screamed the word transitory for months. Oops, runaway inflation. Post the 2000 recession, the Fed left Fed funds below CPI for a long period, which contributed to the housing bubble that was Greenspan. So you'll excuse me for my lack of faith and bad policy by the Fed. And note, all these people have advanced degrees, most of them PhDs. The ones I mentioned, Georgetown, MIT, NYU, and Yale. So just because they're brilliant writing academic papers doesn't mean they have the right call. The president, the chairman of the Fed said subprime is contained and we're not going to be a recession. Within a year, the world came to an end. So I don't know. Excuse me for not believing that the Fed has all the right answers, but I do think they're going to be. They keep saying they're going to raise. I think the market's telling them something else, and I think with the market slowing, they're going to be forced at the very least to stop raising, and then at some point in the not so distant future, start cutting. Earnings are coming down. We're starting to see more companies, talk about the consumer and concerns around it.
Those are great points, Eric. And if you just go over that point, those points again, and read the headlines and the outcomes, it's almost sadly comical. You're correct. And given all this, you know, how can investors and our users monitor credit conditions and keep abreast of the broader implications? What do you think the key barometers are for everybody to follow here?
Okay, so I'm going to outline a handful. First, consumer data. I keep harping on crashing savings, right? Max out credit cards, wages not keeping up with inflation. How much will the consumer retract over the next 12 months? The consumer drives U.S. economy, accounts for about 70% of GDP. We're seeing retail data that was weaker. Computer Discount Warehouse came out in the last 24 hours talking about demand destruction. The first quarter was much weaker, and they're forecasting a much weaker year. Discovery Financial, a big credit card company, basically saw much harder charge-off rates, up 126 basis points from the same period last year. And so basically almost double. And so we're starting to see cracks in the system. So watch the consumer bank lending. I talked about all these evidence, and the San Francisco Fed talked about how they're seeing a pullback. You know, watch for headlines on that. Earnings, we're already forecast to be down 7.5% in the first quarter. How do they look for the rest of the year? And when they give you the first quarter results, what are they saying about the rest of the year? Are they downwardly revising their remainder of the year results? Rates, as I said, on a positive note, I think rate hikes are almost done. But on the negative news, why? It's because the economy is slowing down and the consumer is slowing down. Will the Fed get it right? Unfortunately, I just don't have as much faith in the Fed for the reasons outlined. And then inflation. You know, I called for peak inflation last summer and I was right down to like a couple of weeks. And I do again think this is a Fed mistake and government overspending. I do worry that China coming back online and the oil supply disruption that we're talking about with OPEC plus cutting 1.2 million barrels a day, you know, can cause a couple of blips. But I do think overall we're in a slowing economy. And then last is the debt point is the debt ceiling. It's been in the press. You know, there's a debt ceiling issue, and we've had over 75 debt limit raises since 1960. And if you remember, in 2011, it became quite contentious, so much so that S&P downgraded the credit rating of the United States. And although I do not believe that we will default, and I believe cooler heads will prevail, I am a little bit worried about some saber rattling and headlines between now and the ultimate outcome, which could lead to some volatility and market reaction. In 2011, between April and October, the market sold off 20%, and the big driver was the debt ceiling issue. And it sold off 16% in just 5 weeks in July and August. So, you know, there was no default, but you know, there was a lot of talk on it. My longer term fears around growing deficits, the fading reliance on the U.S. dollar, and the impact of higher debt and interest rate levels coupled with an aging population. I write a lot about that in my piece with charts. Non-discretionary spending around education, healthcare, defense, and debt service will crowd out almost all other spending over the next 10 and 20 years. And as a country, I think we all need to be more mindful and judicious about how we're spending capital, and we need to rein in spending. We need leadership willing to take tough decisions. And I think, unfortunately, these politicians' first job after they get elected is to get reelected rather than getting to the right decision, because the right decision is not always popular with constituents. More baby boomers are turning 65 each day, and we cannot afford to give the full benefits away the way we did 40 years ago when the average lifespan was, you know, 15 years less. In 1960, we had 17 million people over 65 years old, and it's approaching 60 million and growing. And so with that backdrop, I think we have to be mindful of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and how we're spending money. And people are going to have to work longer if you're living longer. If you're living a lot longer, you're going to have to work longer in order to afford it.
Well, that's a great rundown and a great conversation, Eric. Thank you. A lot of food for thought, a lot of things to follow, a lot of concerns we can also watch out for longer term. So thanks for spending time with us. We'll look forward to reading the Rosen Report, of course, and catching up and seeing how all this plays out. Thanks.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for including me. And you can find the Rosen Report on Substack. Thank you so much.